The Church of God the Eternal presents the 22nd message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, February 28th, 2026.
We're going to continue on this series that I've entitled The Survey of the Books of Samuel. We're already up now to the 22nd message in the series, which happens to coalesce and meet up with the 22nd chapter of 1 Samuel. So far I'm kind of averaging one chapter per sermon. We're not halfway through because we're talking about both books of Samuel, and with all of, I think, the total of 55 chapters total. And so we're only on 22, so we're not to the halfway point, but we're starting to get toward that point in the story of David. Last time, if you'll recall, we covered all of chapter 21. We saw that David is now seriously on the run from King Saul. He took refuge with the men at the small village of Nob, which is where the tabernacle was headquartered. And he asked the high priest for bread for his men. So he basically escaped out of the realm of Saul with just a very small small band of men. And after a few days, showed up in Nob, literally asking for bread. The high priest Ahimelech made an exception to allow them to eat the, I'm going to call it the retired showbread, that once it had done its duty literally in the holy place and then was supposed to be for the consumption of the high priest and his family, shared it then with authority with David and his men. At that very same time, there was a spy of King Saul named Doeg the Edomite who was in the vicinity and actually saw David there with the high priest. David takes the sword of Goliath, which ironically it was being stored there within the tabernacle. He got away basically without even any of his armaments. So the high priest lets him take the sword of Goliath with him. He flees on, goes to the city of Gath among the Philistines. And I wish we had more details about that. We ended last time with the end of that. Did he go in there with his men? Did he go in there by himself? Whatever, he went into the gated city, ostensibly incognito, and then was found out, brought before the king, the Philistine king of Gath, and in order to save his life, he basically feigned insanity. And they basically then punted him out of the city. So that's where we left off at the end of chapter 21. Chapter 22 now, 1 Samuel 22, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to entitle this section, David Becomes Like Robin Hood. Not because David ever set on a task to rob from the rich and give to the poor, but everything else about the storyline reminds me very much of the Robin Hood tales. So you see if you agree with me on that. 1 Samuel 22, verse 1, David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. Verse 2, and everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. Okay, let's dissect those first two verses. First, where is this cave? Now, he flees back out of the Philistine territory, so now he's back, in essence, on the Israelite side of the border in Judah. All right? This cave of Adullam, and none of the modern scholars know exactly where it is, but the very area of it, it's in this area of an ancient Canaanite city, and it was called even back then Adullam, in the lowland foothills of Judah. It's a rugged area southwest of Jerusalem, 15 to 20 miles. near the Valley of Elah. Do you remember where the Valley of Elah was? That was the very valley where the big confrontation between David and Goliath took place, where David slew Goliath. So ironically, David is right back in the very vicinity of the place where he came to prominence by killing the Philistine giant. And this is all this area which is a borderland. So you're right on the border between that which was controlled, the actual proper tribe of Judah, and the edge of all of that land that was then controlled by the Philistines. Shouldn't have been controlled by the Philistines had the Israelites known what they should have done. God would have given them the whole thing. So they're under this continual curse with the Philistines literally sharing a border with them. So David now, because he's on the run from King Saul, he's basically staying in this, what I'm calling a no man's land, right there on the edge between that which is controlled by the Jews and the Philistines, which is one of the reasons why the Philistines set up their army in array to challenge the Israelites right in that area, because it was right on the borderland between the two of them. So now here David is, he's trying to hide between basically two kingdoms because he's an outcast of both. So he's right there in that same area. This is where supposedly this cave system, and it's supposedly an area that's with many natural caves in the limestone hills. There's actually a modern day national park in Israel now called the Adullam Cave Park. I think it's got over 10,000 acres in it or whatever. So modern scholars think this particular cave, they don't know where this particular cave was that David congregated or hid, but the entire cave system is right there in that particular geography. All right, so isn't it interesting now that he's a vagabond, he's an outcast, he's on the run from King Saul, he's got no home, and yet all of a sudden he's attracting all these followers. That's why I'm saying it reminds me of the Robin Hood tales. Now, which came first? Well, this long predated any of the stories that came out of Old England about Robin Hood. And I suspect that the best and the most popular stories historically of human beings come or copied from one of the biblical stories. That's often the case. Anyway, so what we've, so remember, this is still a very young man. How old is David at this point? Is he 20? Maybe 22 at the most? Again, we're talking about the very early part of his flight from King Saul after having been a celebrated champion in his court, married his second oldest daughter, and all of a sudden now he goes from the approbation of the entire nation and now Saul's trying to kill him. But he's probably still no more than 20. I'm thinking of him at this age, at this time, at 20 years old. And yet here now he's attracting all this attention because there's a whole lot of other forgotten people. So not only does his own family, including his father Jesse and his mother and his brothers, apparently are all part of this entourage that seek him out because they're all under fire too. Remember, Saul's after all of them. And if he can use David's family in order to get to him, he absolutely will do it, which means they're now all on the run as well. Which is why now his family is flocking to him and all of these others in the nation who are castoffs. It's got to be a combination of military men, soldiers who were loyal to him because of his exploits now, and he's gained this reputation as a champion of Israel. So he's got a certain amount of the military acceptance and his followers, as well as, it says, all of these ones who are discontented, the ones that are in debt, the cast-offs from the whole society under Saul. And now they're flocking to him. And it says there were with him about 400 men. Now, if that's fighting men, and it doesn't clarify it here, but if you're talking about, in essence, now he's had attracted to him 400 fighting men plus all the families, what's the true size of this entourage? But think about that now from a logistical standpoint of what it would take. You're in the wilderness with all of these people and somehow you got to feed them. How do you take care of, in essence, a village, a vagabond nomadic village now of people. And that had, and God does not choose to give us the answer to any of that. But it was a major issue. And it was a major issue for a young man like David to take that weight of responsibility upon his shoulders. All right, continuing on verse 3. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. So he didn't stay, apparently, for long in this cave of Adullam. Why? Well, very likely because he needed a means better to take care of his family and all of these followers. So where's he going to go? Moab. Why is he going to go to Moab? Moab is one of the hardened enemy nations of Israel. Well, so true was the Philistines on the western side, and now you've got Moab and Ammon are the ones, remember, on the other side of the Jordan River, on the other side of the Dead Sea. So now we're talking about David went to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. David is looking for a temporary place where he can gather himself, get his act together, and figure out what he's supposed to do. And he's got this huge entourage of followers that are with him. So where is this? And again, the scholars don't know exactly where Mizpah of Moab was. They think it was possibly the same place mentioned in Isaiah 15:1 as a key Moabite stronghold. It appears to have been a prominent hilltop fortress city in central Jordan. And if that is true, then based upon where he was at this cave of Adullam, you're talking about 50 to 60 miles away. So that's how long with all of these people he was trekking in order to literally get out of Judah, to try and get out of the realm of King Saul to a, quote, safe place. Now, why would he go to Moab? Well, on one side, you can say, you know the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's what David's looking for. If King Saul is the enemy of David, David's hoping that he can get basically some love from the enemies of Saul. With a common agenda there. But again, he's trying to get outside of Saul's jurisdiction, and there's no other way to do that except to go to one of the enemies of Israel, which is why first he was in the lands of the Philistines, and now he's over in Moab on the other side of the Dead Sea in modern-day Jordan. What is another reason why he went to Moab? Remember that David's great-grandmother was a Moabitess. You know who that was, right? Ruth. So don't forget the family ties here, even though God didn't choose to emphasize it in the storyline yet. He did in the book of Ruth. You can read that for yourself. Remember, Ruth, as a widow, followed her mother-in-law back to Israel. And then ultimately, because of her unusual character, God accepted her. Even though the Moabites were on the list, that God told Israel, never marry with the Moabites, the Ammonites and the Moabites. Why? Because they were pagan to the core, and they were the enemy of Israel. And God told his people, do not intermarry with these people. And by the way, that was not a racial thing, because they were all part of the same greater family. They were all Semitic, if you will. Why? Because who was Moab and who was his brother Ammon? They were the sons of Lot, who was the nephew of Abraham. So you're talking about the same large family of peoples out of which came these different nations over hundreds of years. But the Moabites, as well as the Ammonites, became bitter enemies of Israel, just like the descendants of Esau and Ishmael. So Israel surrounded by enemies, both family and those who attached themselves to these extended family members. But understand that God made an exception when it came to Ruth. even though she should never have been allowed or permitted to marry into an Israelitish family. Boaz should never have married her, except God made an exception because of her very fine character. And so I would say, along with the example of Rahab the harlot in the book of Joshua, again, it wasn't a racial thing with these Canaanites, but it was a religious thing with the Canaanites when God said, do not intermarry with them whatsoever. And yet he made an exception with Rahab because of her character and the choices that she made to show loyalty to Israel and to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And therefore, she became permitted literally to marry into an Israelitish family and became part of the ancestry of Jesus Christ, along with Ruth. So it's really, really interesting. And there's all kind of people who want to try and, you know, justify, you know, all kind of things to clean up either the reputation of Rahab, let alone Ruth. But the reality is, what God did was show that it's not to him an issue of race or creed, it's an issue of personal character. That's ultimately what God is looking for. He's looking for individuals who choose to pick him and to be loyal to him and to honor him. And so the exceptions that are made in the family tree of Jesus Christ, including Rahab and including Ruth, are evidence of that. So that's just to remind you of the backstory of the fact that one of the reasons that David fled to Moab, likely because of a family connection. Now, there's no evidence whatsoever that Ruth had any connection to, you know, the king of Moab or the ruling class. Nothing is said about that in the book of Ruth whatsoever. So we really don't know. But I think it's reasonable to assume that the fact that, and remember, David's parents, Jesse and his mother, are in this entourage, which means Ruth was his grandmother. So that's how close we're talking about the ties were. Is it possible then that that gave David an in with the king of Moab to ask for a favor now? That's what he does. He tries to get absolutely out of the realm of King Saul, beyond his reach. Now, I'll make a little bit of a departure just to make a comment on this. Isaiah 16, verse 3 through 5. Here's a prophecy that applies to the last days, and yet it's rooted historically. Mr. Cole used to talk about the fact that God deals very often with types and antitypes, allows history to repeat itself in order to prophesy events that are coming. I think this is one of them. Isaiah 16:3 says, take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast, bewray not him that wandereth. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. So here is a prophecy concerning the Moabites literally providing a haven for the people of God in a time of distress. Now, Isaiah wrote this hundreds of years after the days of David. And yet, it appears that this is exactly one of the things that took place now in the life of young David with his family, being protected, at least for a period of time, by the enemies of Israel in the form of these Moabites. And here's a prophecy now for the future that says, let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a cover to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceases, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. Verse 5, and in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. So here you're talking about the tabernacle of David. It is connected in some way with being shielded and protected for a time by whoever is represented by Moab. And so this absolutely happened right here in the life of young David, including the protection for himself and for his mother and his father and this entire entourage. There's another particular splinter group led by a former minister of Worldwide who considers himself a prophet, who's had egg all over his face for decades and decades. So he came up with this interpretation that after the failed attempt, the worldwide and under Mr. Armstrong, the theory was that this place of safety is going to be in Petra, in Jordan. And this prophecy in Isaiah 16 was one of the texts that was used to give credence to it, the fact that the Jordanians in the last days are going to be the ones who are literally going to provide a haven for those of God's church who are going to protect it in a place of safety. Okay, so Petra was the entire, thing about it. Well, this particular splinter group leader, because he's trying to carry on and sees himself, as a prophet and the continuation of an apostle like Mr. Armstrong, he literally went over to Jordan years ago to try and arrange with the Jordanian government a right, basically to have his little conclave over there so he could move his church over there. That totally blew up. I don't know what happened, didn't care to look at the details, but all of a sudden, the idea of him taking his church to Petra, the door got slammed on that. So guess what he did? A number of years ago, he came up with a new theory. He came up with the theory that the real place of safety isn't going to be in Jordan. It's going to be in the cave of Adullam, where David hid with all of his entourage over on near the West Bank. And so now, and I guess that's still the thing. I don't keep up with it. I hear people give me updates every once in a while. But supposedly that's the latest, greatest prophecy, because they have to try and keep their membership titillated in some way with the hope of physically saving their skin. And that's what their church is all about, guaranteeing them a place and a place of safety when the great tribulation comes upon the earth. Where's developing character? Where's focusing yourself on literally putting on the mind of Jesus Christ? Where is the willingness to be a martyr if God requires it? No, it's all about coveting a place of physical safety to save your skin before the return of Jesus Christ. So they always have to have something. So this cave of Adullam is one of those things which you might run into with some of the Church of God people at large who are kind of all focused and fixated on that as their new place of refuge. I don't know how that's going either. But anyway, back to 1 Samuel 22, verse 4. So David has moved his entourage into Moab. He brought them, including his father Jesse and his mother, before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. Now, I had to look this up and like, okay, what are we talking about? And it literally, it's referring to the stronghold. And my first thought was, well, wait a minute. Did he take his family over to Moab, and then did he go back to Judah over to the cave system where he was hiding? Is that the stronghold where he was before? The scholars don't think that's true. Most of the scholars think this was a fortress type stronghold in Moab near the city where he deposited his parents and his family. Okay. And this Mizpah of Moab might fit that description, where in essence, David may have been literally, hanging out in this rugged mountain fortress, even while his family is a little bit more comfortable digs with the king of Moab in a nearby city. Whatever it is, this stronghold seems to have been in Moab. And the impetus for that seems to follow in verse 5, because in verse 5 we read, the prophet Gad. Okay, let's stop right there. Who is this? The prophet Gad. Never heard of him before. And in fact, there is no reference to him before this very verse. So here is a new character who comes on the scene. We have little information about him, except he is a legitimate prophet of God. And now here he is with David in Moab. Now, we're going to see this same prophet emerge in the storyline in the life of David later on, especially in 2 Samuel 24. Which, fast forward, was long after David was king. And remember one of those mistakes David made when he actually numbered Israel against the will of God? He took a census of the entire nation because he had his confidence in the number of fighting men that he had at his disposal rather than just trusting God in faith. So after this 9-month project to send Joab and his men out, literally to take a head count of everyone in the nation, especially the fighting men, this 9-month project, they came back and reported the numbers, and he's got like 1.5 million fighting men. And then his heart smote him because he knew he'd done the wrong thing. Well, who was it that came to David and spoke in the name of God in order to tell him he messed up and gave him his options on what to do? It was the same prophet, Gad. In 2 Samuel 24, he's actually called David seer. And seer was just another word for prophet. Somebody who is inspired by God, literally with the ability to tell you things that are going to happen in the future for reason. Okay? So that's who this man Gad is. Very little else is said about him, but he's going to be literally making appearances throughout the story now, between now and the end of the life of David. And here's his first appearance now, where God sends this prophet to David. And what did he say? The prophet Gad said to David, "Abide not in the hold," meaning in this stronghold where you have been fortifying yourself. "Depart and get you into the land of Judah," meaning get out of Moab and get back into Israelite territory, even though that's where Saul's waiting to try to kill you. Here's this prophet of God telling David, God does not want you to stay in safety over here in Moab, even though it's pretty comfortable by comparison. So he says, "Depart and get you into the land of Judah." Then David departed and came into the forest of Herath. Well, where was that? The forest of Herath was right back over in that same borderland area that we've been talking about the whole time. Whether you're talking about the cave of Adullam, whether you're talking about the valley where David killed Goliath, it's all in that very same region, within a few miles of each other. Modern scholars say that site, the forest of Herath, was probably 3 to 5 miles east of Keilah. Well, what's Keilah? You're going to find that out in the next segment, because in chapter 23, there's a big storyline concerning the fortified city of Keilah. So this forest of Herath, where David now goes when he leaves Moab, is right back in the same vicinity where he's been hanging out. It fits the description of the mountainous border and wooded land of that geography. Okay. On to verse 6. Saul finds out that David's in the area. Now, how long was he in Moab? How long was he hiding out? We don't know. It likely was a few weeks, even maybe a few months. The Bible storyline does not tell us, but he was there long enough that God sent Gad as a prophet to tell him, your time over here is up. You need to come back. You need to come back to Judah. So verse 6, when Saul heard that David was discovered, they found him. He had disappeared off the map for a time. He was out of the country. Now he's back. When Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah, which is his headquarters. That's his capital city from where he rules the nation. Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, which was his common thing. And all his servants were standing about him. Verse 7, then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites." So stop right there. Basically, Saul has surrounded himself with his own countrymen, those who came out of his own tribe. Remember, Saul himself was a Benjamite. He's incredibly paranoid, as you're going to find out. And so he has apparently surrounded himself with ones that he thinks he can trust the most. He doesn't even trust people from the other tribes of his own country. Probably especially not from Judah, since that's where David is from. So he's highly mistrustful. The Benjamites and the land of the Benjamites is right there adjoining the tribe of Judah and their lands from where he rules in Gibeah. Saul says unto the servants that stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? Saul seems to be obsessed with his comparison to David, and he's worried that his men and his officers and his courtiers are in danger of going over to David if they think that David might actually offer them a better deal to make him the king instead of Saul. So Saul is in this total defensive posture. Everything he sees is based on his paranoia and worried about David. So he's looking around even at his closest supporters and his soldiers. And he's saying, are you two, you know, can David provide you what I'm providing you? Well, why is that even an issue? Because it's an issue in the mind of Saul. That's why. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? Verse 8, that all of you have conspired against me. Here's the paranoia. That all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that shows me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or shows unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait, as at this day. If that's not paranoia, I don't know what is. So what do we learn from this little soliloquy that Saul has uttered to his supporters? Saul has no concrete proof that his son Jonathan has actually done anything considered treason. Saul knows it, and it's true if you consider it treason that Jonathan has been in contact with and made a covenant with David, who is the enemy of Saul, and Saul's trying to kill David, and anybody helping David is the enemy of Saul, then yes, then Jonathan is guilty of treason. Is it true that Jonathan is trying to overthrow his father's rule? No! Has Jonathan done anything to threaten or show disrespect to the office of his father as the anointed of God over Israel? No! Is that the way Saul sees it? Absolutely not. So Saul has concluded that his son Jonathan, who is the heir apparent, by the way, if Saul dies, that Jonathan is a conspirator and guilty of treason. And what he's saying now to all of this court around him, including the soldiers of the tribe of Benjamin that he surrounds himself with, is, and none of you have come forward with evidence. I know Jonathan is a traitor, but none of you have helped me prove it. That's in essence what he's saying. And so now he's saying all of them are part of the conspiracy. You see how the paranoia goes? A lot of the commentators describe this as classic paranoia. Saul feels isolated. He accuses without evidence and uses guilt, this none of you is sorry for me, as a way to pressure his servants into remaining loyal or else, you know, to become snitches to try and help him accomplish what he wants to accomplish already in his mind. He's looking for people to tell him what he wants to hear, that all of his fears and all his paranoia is rooted in the truth. The truth is his son Jonathan is not against him, and the greater truth is that David's not even against him. David is not against Saul. And this is one of the big lessons you're going to see throughout this entire story, and one of the reasons that I picked it, even to want to do an entire series on the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, is to demonstrate to you the absolutely unique orientation of mind that David had, especially and even after he was being attacked by Saul. How many of us, once, if you were innocent and all of a sudden the king turned against you and was trying to kill you and you had to go on the run, you and I, by nature, would think, well then, all bets are off. I'm totally justified in defending myself, including trying to kill him before he kills me. That's the natural human reaction anyway. And I'm previewing this. You're going to get the first sense of this in chapter 23 next time. The fact that David's orientation is totally different. He is not looking for an opportunity to kill Saul or to neutralize him so that he can either save himself, let alone descend to the kingship. That is not his orientation, which makes him incredibly unusual among human beings. But that doesn't mean that's not exactly the way Saul's interpreting it. Saul is being influenced by enemy spirits. He's given himself emotionally over to this influence, which is feeding the paranoia, which makes everyone around him an enemy. So none of his courtiers, none of the Benjamites around him that he supposedly trusts, are willing to tell him what he wants to hear, to give him evidence. Oh yeah, David's here, or David's there, or Jonathan did this and we've got evidence. No, there's none of that. So who steps up? Verse 9. Then answered Doeg the Edomite. You remember him? How many days or weeks? Well, this likely was weeks before, because again, we don't know how long David was on the run, has been on the run up to now, and how long he was in Moab. He was likely in Moab for several weeks, if not months. So months down the line, let's say, now this story comes out. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse come to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, meaning the high priest. He's finally revealing this story that happened weeks or months previously. I saw the son of Jesse come to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Eternal for him, meaning the high priest actually sought God's counsel to help David. That's the claim, which is a lie, by the way, as I'm going to prove to you. But Doeg says, he, Ahimelech, inquired of the Eternal for David and gave him victuals, gave him food, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. So what do we have here? Partial truth. Did the high priest give David and his men something to eat? Yeah. Did he approve for David to take the sword of Goliath? Yes. Everything else is a lie, and especially the context. Have you ever been a victim of this, where somebody literally is out to get you and they tell a lot of truth, but they tell it in a certain way in order to make it flavor to imply your intention was evil, and you find yourself on the defensive? That's partly what happened, but that's not what was going on. Have you ever felt that? That's what's going on now in this accusation against David. Verse 11, then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. Remember, as the high priest, he is a Levite. He's of the tribe of Levi, and very specifically, not just of any family of Levi, but of the family of Aaron. You could not be high priest unless you were of the specific family with Aaron as your ancestor, which he was, because remember, Ahitub and his son Ahimelech go back to Eli from the days of young Samuel. And I'll rehearse that a little bit next time, just as a reminder. But anyway, he says, the king sent and called Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, all of the relatives, meaning all of the other priests of the same family, the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, why have you conspired against me? How are you going to answer this? How are you going to defend yourself against an accusation? Saul says, why have you conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse? In that thou hast given him bread and a sword and has inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait, as at this day. He says, you've been in league with my enemy who's trying to kill me, and you even besought God's advice for him to help him literally take me off the throne. How does the high priest answer? Verse 14, then Ahimelech answered the king and said, Who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law? Himelech is saying, I had no reason to know that you even had a falling out with David. The last thing I knew, he's your favored son-in-law, the champion in Israel, fulfilling your will at the head of your army. And all of a sudden, Saul is saying, David is my great enemy, and because you helped him, you're my enemy too, and guilty of treason. Like, where is this coming from? Who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goes at thy bidding, and is honorable in thy house? That's the last thing the high priest knew. Verse 15, he says further, did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. In spite of what Doeg the Edomite said, the high priest here is saying, I never made a request of God on David's behalf to give guidance to David in what he should do or where he should go. The high priest is saying that did not happen. And by the way, if you look back at the account in chapter 21, you will not find that that happened. When David came with his men, what did he ask for? He asked for food, and he asked for the sword. And then he went on his way. He did not ask for the high priest to intercede and ask God for a divine input on what he should do. That did not happen. But that doesn't mean that this Edomite Doeg wasn't willing to lie about it in order to make it appear that David was guilty and by extension now the high priest. Did I then begin, verse 15 again, to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father. For thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. There's his testimony before the king, and he's telling the truth. Now, what's Saul going to do? Is he going to be a wise ruler? Is he going to be fair and just? Verse 16, the king said, thou shalt surely die. He passes judgment upon the high priest as if it's his domain. Literally, you can put the high priest of God to death. The king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, remember all these Benjamites that were part of his entourage. The king said unto the footmen that stood about him, turn and slay the priests of the Eternal. Isn't it interesting that Saul literally called them the priests of God? And he commands his soldiers to kill the high priest and his entire family, all the priests of Israel, which are the priests of the Most High God. What frame of mind must Saul be in? Turn and slay the priests of the Eternal, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. As if the high priest should have come running to Saul after David's visit. Remember what happened? David lied to the high priest. He told him he was on a secret mission from Saul. Nobody knew about it. The high priest had no reason to believe that David wasn't telling the truth. He was not part of some conspiracy to undermine Saul. But that's now the story that Saul has adopted in order to convict him. He knew when he fled and did not show it to me, but the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Eternal. That was even too much for his closest acolytes. They knew that was dead wrong to raise their hand against the high priest and his entire family. So who were the traitors? Maybe he should have had all the Benjamites killed. But this is how divorced he became from reality. Literally, when he's telling his soldiers to kill the entire high priest and his family, and it gets worse than that, by the way. And his own people, his closest supporters, are like, we're not going to do that. That's a bridge too far. we are not going to lift our hand against the priests. Verse 18, and the king said to Doeg, who's an Edomite, he's not an Israelite, he really doesn't care. He's a gun for hire. The king said to Doeg, turn thou and fall upon the priests. And Doeg the Edomite turned, and apparently this, not him single-handedly, he had to have had his own armed men at his disposal who were not loyal to the Israelites or the priests of Israel. Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priest and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. That's 85 priests, by the way. That's 85 priests. Verse 19, it didn't stop there. Those were just the ones who were called to Gibeah for this audience at the king's court. Was Saul happy just to kill Ahimelech and all of these priests, his family, of the men? Nope. Verse 19, and Nob, the city of the priest, which is where the tabernacle resided, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. Saul commanded an absolute purge, man, woman, and child, to make an example out of the high priest, his entire family, even their little children. I think it's ironic that just decades before Saul lost the support of God because he refused to follow God's instruction through Samuel, remember, which was to kill Agag, the Amalekite. Remember that? God sent him down there with very specific instructions to wipe out the Amalekites, leave no one, man, woman, or child alive, and none of the animals, kill them all. And Saul refused to do it. So he wouldn't kill all of the Amalekites, but he would kill all the priests of God and all of their families and their little children and all of their animals. Ironic, isn't it? When someone departs from God who knows better, they become worse than anybody in the world. There is no greater enemy to the people of God than the ones who were once part of the people of God who have now turned hateful. And that's a lesson all the way through the Bible. And I'm very sure that it likely is going to become a factor in the very last days before the return of Jesus Christ as well. That the greatest enemies of the people of God are going to be those who were once part of the household of God, who have now turned so bitter against God and his way that they'll do anything to try to justify their conscience. And they will become part of a program to try to eradicate everything that bothers their conscience because they were once part of it. If you don't think that there's demonic influence involved in that, guess again. Because Satan does stir up those feelings and capitalize upon it. And people end up doing things that they never would have realized they were even capable of. So Saul, poor weak-minded Saul, is a case study of what happens when you start off well, and yet you allow, through compromise, yourself to turn against God's instruction. And then you go downhill, and this is where it is now. Apparently, Samuel is still alive at this point, but Samuel's not in the storyline. In his old age, what would he have thought to see Saul, whom he loved dearly, actually engage in this kind of behavior? So 85 priests plus all of their families are slaughtered. Only one of them escapes. Verse 20. One of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. God doesn't choose to record how he escaped. Now, apparently, because Saul summoned all of the priests, and Abiathar would have been, as one of the sons of the high priest, would have been in that priestly entourage that came up to Gibeah for a command performance before Saul. Unless he was sick or he was out of place or whatever, it doesn't tell us. Somehow Abiathar escaped. If he came up to Gibeah with the entourage, that it must have been when Doeg and his men started slaughtering the priest, Abiathar ran and got away, as opposed to all the rest who did not. However the storyline happened, Abiathar was the only one of Ahimelech's family that escaped slaughter and fled after David. Verse 21, and Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Eternal's priest. Abiathar was the one to report the horrible news to David of what Saul had done. And David said, verse 22, unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul. So David, in hindsight, is looking back and saying, I knew no good was going to come out of the fact that that Edomite was there and saw me with your father. David says, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house. David feels responsible, takes responsibility for the fact that that entire priestly line was wiped out, except for Abiathar. Nothing he can do about it now. Verse 23, David says, abide thou with me. Fear not, for he that seeks my life seeks thy life. He's saying we're in the same boat together. Saul is trying to kill me. He's also trying to kill you. But David says, with me thou shalt be in safeguard. David is pledging to look after Abiathar, to protect him and to shield him. He's the last of his entire family. So David takes responsibility principally for the massacre. He says, it's my fault that it happened. And in a way, think about this. Had David not lied to Ahimelech when he went to Nob? And it seemed like a white lie, right? No big deal. I mean, come on. He's on the run with just a small band of guys. He's running from Saul, running for his life. He shows up in Nob. He tells the high priest this white lie. Oh, yeah, I'm on this secret mission from Saul. No one's supposed to know about it, which is why I'm kind of here all by myself, and we don't have even our armor and our weapons. We're on the secret mission of Saul. We could really use some food, and that sword of Goliath would come in handy too. So he tells the lie, and it seems innocent. Who's going to get hurt by it? Here's an example. What if it had happened differently? What if David had showed up in Nob and said to the high priest and literally told him the truth, saying, you have no reason to help me, and in fact, you probably shouldn't. Saul is trying to kill me, and I'm on the run. I'm running for my life right now, but I'm begging you to help me and my men and give us something to eat. What if he had done that? At least Ahimelech, the high priest, had the option then to have made his own decision with full knowledge of what he was dealing with. What would he have done? Would he have said, I'm sorry, I'm loyal to Saul. If Saul's trying to kill you, I'm not going to help you. I won't hit you with a 10-foot pole. Be on your way. But it's possible that the high priest, in spite of David telling the truth, would have showed mercy and fed him anyway and helped him. We just don't know, because that's not what happened. The fact is, David took away the opportunity for the high priest to make his own decision by lying to him. David takes responsibility for the massacre of the high priest's entire family line because of that lie. Now, you and I wouldn't be as hard on David. We would say, you know, there's no way he could have known. And by the way, God allowed this to happen. That's not a justification, but it is true. God could have prevented it. Remember, God is the one who sent the prophet Gad to call David back from his refuge in Moab and says, you need to come back to Judah. And because of that, now all these events are unfolding. So in the final analysis, God knew it was going to happen. God ultimately is responsible. He didn't protect Ahimelech and all his family. He could have done it. He didn't. He allowed Saul to slaughter them all. Abiathar, as you're going to find out in the future, would become a loyal personal priest and counselor to David through many trials throughout his life. He's going to be one of those personal priests. If you're talking about the Robin Hood story, he's like Friar Tuck. That's the way I'm pitching it. Okay? His spiritual counselor, who's there along with him. And now he is the high priest. Now that his father is dead and his entire family line, Abiathar is the only one left of the priestly line of Aaron, of that family branch. And so he now assumes the position as high priest, even though he is now on the run with David as an outlaw. So look at this entourage. David's got surrounding him 400, as we're going to find now that in chapter 23, it's going to increase to 600. He's got this increasing band of outcasts in the nation who have now rallied around David. David is their champion. He is their leader. And God is going to help them avoid certain death at the hand of the king. This is going to unfold over many years, by the way. If it's true that David is only around 20 years old, 21, 22 at most, he assumes the role as king over the southern kingdom of Judah at age 30, after Saul dies. So the assumption is, now we're talking about this period of time that David is on the run, anywhere from 8 to 10 years. And this is just the beginning of it. The beginning of this 8 to 10 year period of flight, where David is running from it for his life the entire period of time until Saul dies. So that's what is in store for David. Abiathar would become a loyal priest throughout this entire period of time, and in fact, through the entire reign of David, once he's on the throne. Just to give you a little bit of the advanced story, in his old age, Abiathar is going to make a serious mistake. We'll get to that. When David is very old, David is setting the stage for his son Solomon to assume the throne after David dies. David's putting all this together. Abiathar makes the mistake of siding instead with one of the other sons of David who aspires to the throne. And because Abiathar makes that mistake, once David dies and Solomon coalesces his power and assumes to the throne, all of a sudden Abiathar is going to be out. Solomon's not going to kill him. He's going to show respect for all of his years of service to David, but he's in essence going to put him in exile back to his own lands. And this is also going to fulfill a prophecy that God actually pronounced upon the high priest Eli and all of his family, because remember, Abiathar is a part of the family of Eli. So there's all of these threads of prophecy that are all intertwined with these family lines and these stories that are being played out. So I could have kind of kept that as a secret to the end, but you can read the Bible and you've read these stories, so you probably know them in part anyway. I'm just reminding you of them in advance, so that when we get ultimately to that, all of these elements in the early part of the storyline with young Abiathar, it's going to make more sense to you along the way. Next time, we continue with the saga of David and his outlaw band of soldiers and priests as we take up chapter 23.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 22nd message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, February 28th, 2026.